I would argue that people who have learned second language later in their life, so meaning somebody who didn't grow up learning two languages, I started learning second language as an adolescent. So for those people who are lifelong language learners that started later, I feel like the word fluency doesn't really mean much anymore because I've been speaking Spanish for almost 20 years and I still don't feel like I'm fluent. I've been studying French for over 20 years. I still don't feel like I'm fluent. So people who are lifelong learners will never feel like they've made it. You know what I mean?
This is the Educational Triage Podcast. Welcome. We invite you to come along with us on an exploration of interviews, issues, and other exciting and relevant topics in education, especially alternative education. They say alternative education is a laboratory for mainstream education. Why? Well, join us every week and listen in as Philip Summers,
aloha,
and I, Tony Hunt, jump in feet first to discuss issues that may affect our classes, students, communities, as well as our teaching. Please subscribe if you enjoy and find relevance in what you experience here. And if you haven't left a quick review, please do. We appreciate your candor and insights so we can improve as we move forward. Now, let's see what's on board today. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Educational Triage Podcast. This is Tony, and I am joined with our Philip. Hello, Philip.
Aloha. Hi, Tony.
And today we have an extra special guest with us. We have Alexis Bouchard, who is a polyglot, which means that she speaks several languages. She's learning German right now. She was a Fulbright grantee. She has done extensive travel. She has a huge love for language, and she explores the cultures of those languages. And currently, she is a trainer for a textbook company. And I believe that that textbook company deals in second languages, or maybe third, fourth, fifth, whatever language, but new languages for the learners. So I am going to welcome you, Alexis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I've been thinking about having you on for quite some time because we've known each other for a short time, like a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, I taught at that school for 7 years, so that was a long time.
Oh, that is. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So just to start us off, when people think about learning a second language, a lot of them freeze up if they know that they're going to have to speak a different language or learn a different language. So what creates that anxiety or that hesitancy?
In the language pedagogy field, we actually have a term for that that's called the affective filter. And it's essentially when you get stressed, you have this filter that goes up and prevents you from taking things in. And so one of the things that I think having taught high school language for the years that I did is that when you're walking into a language class, especially if it's your first class in high school, you don't really have a lot of background or foundation to rely on. Whereas if you walk into like a math or science class or English class, you've got some foundation. There's something that's familiar to you. But if you're walking into a Spanish class for the first time and you don't, maybe you can count to 10 and that's it. You don't know any other Spanish. That's really intimidating because you're being confronted with something that's completely new to you. And there's not a lot that you can fall back on. And then depending on your teacher, like the last few years that I taught, I conducted my Spanish 1 classes only in Spanish for the first week. And I did it in a very welcoming, encouraging way. So it wasn't terrifying. I was trying to lower that affective filter. But if you have a student who walks in and they're completely intimidated by that, and as a teacher, you're not making it comprehensible for them, that's going to be a huge red flag and throw that affective filter right up.
So I'm going to twist it around just a little bit. So when a student from another country comes in and they're, because now they decided that they've made the determination that maybe only one period a day can be ELL. English language learning, and the rest they're going to be in regular classrooms. So is it harder for them when everything is being thrown at them, or is it going to be easier for them to learn the language, especially academic language, because the research shows that it takes 6 to 8 years to learn academic language? How effective is that for learning languages? So, for example, if you were to move, let's say that we sent you off to Rome and we put you into a grade school or into a high school or into a university, how long is it going to take you to adapt and learn that language?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm not going to pretend like I know what that experience is like, especially from an adolescent standpoint. That, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, I've never had that experience, so I can't even imagine how terrifying or stressful that can be for a kid. And it was interesting how you said grade school, because littles, our elementary kids, are going to have a much easier time assimilating into that environment than an older student will, because we know that younger children acquire languages a little easier than older people. And that can include teenagers as well. But I think there's two sides to it. If you drop a new student into a new environment where the language is completely different, the benefits are that they are being immersed. So immersion is probably the most effective way to learn a language quickly. And mm-hmm. so if you have a newcomer, an ELL, for example, not only is school going to be in English for them, but they're on the bus with all kids who are speaking English around them. They're watching TV where there's English constantly bombarding them. They have, you know, billboards, advertisements, stores, everything is in English. So they're going to acquire much quicker than a high school student who goes to Spanish class for 4.5 hours a week, because they're not going to get that immersion experience. Mm. So in some ways that makes it easier for that student who's being immersed. However, yeah. The stress and the affective filter that's up all day for them, because maybe the only class they're really getting true support is that ELL period. And then the rest of the time, their teacher in the content area classes is going to have a varying degree of experience teaching somebody who's acquiring language. So they're going to be all over the place in their experiences with their other classes.
It also explains like dialects like Spanglish. Mm-hmm. You know, just the adaptation mm-hmm. between the two languages, making the meaning through one Spanish word inside the English context. Yeah, yes. I've seen a lot of that. And I actually told the girls who were speaking, I go, you know, you've just invented a new language. And I think that's just awesome.
Yeah, well, the families adapt and they create their own idioms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody does it. I just know about that because I was around it and I was just watching that, because I was teaching English at the time as well. So it was fascinating to me how they were forming the languages. I have that. Effective. It's effective.
Affective filter. Yeah.
Affective filter. Yeah. I don't know what it is. I won't hesitate to speak up or be in public. But if I have to speak a language, I just go in circles. I don't want to. I have to force myself. Generally, I'm corrected and said, I speak English, thank you. It's because it's just, to me, it's always been kind of every time I've had that. Took 2 years of college, French.
I think that the truth is, though, is that if you are in that environment where,
yeah,
I think Americans are very, very forgiving when people try to speak Spanish or try to speak English and they're making the attempt to do it. I think that we see a lot of the negative, but that's only for the clicks. But mm-hmm. Americans tend to be some of the nicest people when it comes to people asking directions or asking for something and they're trying to understand what it is that you're trying to say. Yeah. When I was in France, the fact that you attempt to speak French.
Yes.
Especially in Paris. I found the people of Paris to be absolutely wonderful.
They were wonderful, but you had to try to speak French first. Then they go, that's where they said to me, oh, it's okay, I speak English, you know, just kind of courteously. Well, you needn't butcher my language any longer.
France is a really interesting case study, I think, because I think the perception for people from the United States about France in like the 70s, 80s, 90s was that the French were too snobby and you had to speak their language perfectly. So I lived in France. I taught in France for a year. And when I went in 2010, 2011, I did experience some of that. You don't speak French well enough and we are not going to respect that. But then when I went 2 years ago, I couldn't believe the change, especially in Paris, like you said. And I think it's the popularity of American TV and American culture that they want to learn English. So I would start off by speaking in French and they would turn around and speak to me in English. And I would say, no, it's okay. I speak French. And they said, no, I really want to practice my English.
That's fascinating. Wow. Because when I was traveling in Europe in 78, I was traveling with a guy, a Quebecois. And so he spoke and understood fluent French, but if he dared speak it out in Paris, they would just turn this cold shoulder to him. So he'd translate to me, here, that's what they're saying. You know, I go, oh, okay. And then I could kind of form, you know, a response. It was fascinating. He dared not open his mouth. Yeah, so that's interesting to see it's changed. That's great.
But see, you know, even in Switzerland, there were places I went to where they said that they didn't speak any English. And so I said, okay, I'm going to butcher your French. And they said, no, 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 it's charming. And I received the same comments in Paris, and people would sit down and help me practice. And they would, you know, we would speak, and it was really nice.
Of Paris, it's very hospitable. It was that, as far as I could always tell, is that Paris, hey, when you're in Paris, you speak French.
I found it to be hospitable in Paris. Outside of Paris, they were the snobs.
Oh, I was there about 6 years ago. I found it a little different, but that's cool. Yeah. Okay.
In my experience now is it's generational. So the Gen Z, they really want to learn English. And so they're very willing to try it out.
Okay.
That is so fantastic to know. Thank you. Yeah. That makes total sense. We just talked about that too. Generations and how they approach life. Yeah.
But when I moved to South America, I hardly spoke a word of Spanish.
Really?
And I got down there, and so I learned, the people helped me learn the language because I would pantomime what it was that I would want because I didn't have somebody alongside me to translate for me. And then my students were also teaching me language, but they taught me some really foul language, but it was, you laugh.
It's funny.
But I learned so much. And one of my friends, he was one of my neighbors who also taught with me. He and I were riding in a cab and I was having a conversation with a cab driver. And he looked at me and he said, where did you learn to speak like that? And I said, what do you mean? He said, you've only been here for like 5 months and you're having this conversation with the cab driver. And he said, you have learned so many years of school Spanish in a very short amount of time.
Immersion.
And I said, probably because of the immersion and probably because I had no other choice because I'm not hanging out with all the Americans, because there were teachers there who were terrified to speak the language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to raise up a point. Alexis, here's a question. Since we have a romantic base for English, and I'm an English speaker, I can triangulate French to Spanish to English and go, oh, I can understand them. I probably can't respond well, but I can understand it in a way. Is it different with something like Mandarin Chinese?
Yes.
Is that radically different structure? Yeah. It does then. Okay, go ahead.
So as somebody who's studied languages for a long time, there's one like comic or meme that goes around a lot that says, you know, all these, there's a language tree, a language family tree that they can take back all the way to one mother language at one point in time, right? So the joke is that English took other languages down dark alleys, beat them up, stole their words, and ran away. So English, yes. So English technically is a Germanic language, but we have stolen a lot from Romance languages like French and Spanish. And one really interesting thing, if you pay attention to our words in English for government, different types of government, they come from French. A lot of those words are parallel, and you have to think about the politics of the time and democracy and all that kind of thing. So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, French used to be the diplomatic language.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for centuries.
Yes.
Good point.
Tell me your question again, because I got lost. Well, on my
so Mandarin Chinese. I mean,
Mandarin Chinese.
It seems to hit my brain like, what? It has different base altogether. Yeah.
There's an American association. It's called ACTFL, which stands for the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Language. And they're considered the governing body of learning language in the United States. So one quick thing is that the name of that is slightly problematic. And I don't know if they've changed it from foreign language, but we used to refer to our field as foreign language. We don't anymore. It's world language, because languages aren't foreign, right? They're just languages.
That's a kind of Cold War, pre-Cold War state, yes. Foreign.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyways, ACTFL has decided that some languages are harder to learn than others. And there's also a scale of proficiency. And so there are documents that you can find that say, if you study French or Spanish for this many years, you're going to hit this level of proficiency. But if you're studying a language like Mandarin, you're only going to hit this level of proficiency, and it's lower. So languages are essentially graded in difficulty. And so you're right, the Romance languages are going to be graded a little bit easier than a language that has a completely different system of writing or grammatical system or syntax or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you read a lot, or if you really listen a lot to people speaking, and I don't mean people just speaking slang, you can pick up a lot of the meanings of words simply because they have the same basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word for use in French is emploi, and you think employ. So, or utiliser for utilize. And so you can actually get your language going. And you can get that vibe happening.
Those are called cognates. And one of my favorite jokes from teaching, cognates are words you recognize from English.
Yes, which is a base, I imagine, in Latin, cog to mean, yeah.
But I don't remember what I was going to. Oh,
sorry.
Part of the problem, I think, with language learning, though, is the fact that let's say that I came from a different country and I'm trying to learn English. I hear it in the schools, but once I leave schools, it's back to native language time. And so I have 18 hours of native language and maybe 6 hours of the new language. And so what's the best way for, if we're talking about kids who are learning Spanish or French, or I even taught Latin, which was more popular than French or Spanish when I was teaching it. And the kids went haywire with it. Is that there's no practice that really happens outside of the classroom. And so you have maybe an hour and a half and a 6 hour day, and then that's it. Is that going to be, is that a challenge? Or
for teaching world language as a second language?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That you're a student, the fact that we, and first of all, especially in the state of Oregon, we only require, but it's not technically required, to do 2 years of a world language to graduate. And that's not a requirement. That's a recommendation of one of options. There's some states that require certain amounts, but regardless, that amount is barely a drop in the bucket to get a student to be somewhat proficient in that language. Now, it really depends on the teaching style also, I think. But at the same time, if you're a student, let's say you're on a block schedule, like I was teaching on a block schedule. So the most a student would see me is 3 times a week, and that's 4.5 hours. And then you add in, you know, sports or sickness or whatever. Maybe they only see me once a week. Maybe they don't see me at all. So it's really hard to get that input. That's what students need, is they need lots of input that they understand in the target language in order to start to acquire it. So the fact that we require or don't require at all so little language instruction for students in the United States is upsetting to me. I mean, as a language person, and I don't know how. I mean, there's lots of things that we can do as teachers to encourage students to do things outside of the classroom, but it also comes down to, you know, student desire, student motivation. Why are they there?
What's the international model on that? I mean, as far as I know, that English is the language that's universally spoken generally. Yeah. Are they teaching it from an early age?
It depends on what country you're in, but in Europe, for example, they'll start a second language very young, like kindergarten. And then some countries require three languages. So by the time they're in high school, they're studying all three languages, and that includes their first language.
Okay.
So we're way behind. And then when you go to other countries, you know, in other parts of the world, it really varies, but you're right. English is usually the desired language if they don't already speak it.
I knew that. That seems logical to start early, get those patterns kind of laid down.
So what are the best ways to motivate students to learn a language?
Really?
It's a loaded question, to be honest, just because, that's, you know, as teachers, we can only do so much to motivate our students. Mm-hmm. I know why I was motivated as a language learner when I was in middle school and I started taking French is because I really wanted to go to France. That was something that motivated me. And then when I got into college, I, you know, was taking Spanish classes and I really liked my professors and I really respected them and I wanted to do well because of that. So that was a big motivator for me. So we're all going to find our own motivations, right? And I think a lot of students will tell you, I asked them the first day or first couple of days of school, why are you taking a language? And a lot of them tell me, oh, because I have to. And I said, no, actually, you don't have to. You're not required to be here. So what are some other reasons? And so we try to brainstorm some reasons of why. And it's usually to communicate, you know, or to travel. But I think it's really important to help them find their own reason for studying, because if they're there because they think they have to be there or because I want them to be there, it's not a good enough reason. The one thing that I think is really interesting, if a school offers Japanese, for example, you will get so many students who are into manga. And so they take Japanese because they want to be able to interpret it in its original language. And I think that's a great example of intrinsic motivation. For learning.
Yeah, relevance. We talk about that a lot, relationships. When you were speaking about your Spanish, getting interest in Spanish through a teacher, I thought, is there a French teacher, you know, early on that kind of hooked you, you know, on a relationship basis, kept you motivated?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, our middle school French teacher was just such a character. Tony actually knows her. She's such a character and she was so engaging, and middle school kids were just in it. You know, we wanted to be there because it was entertaining.
It was entertaining. I say that too to Tony. I go, I kind of think of me myself as a teacher. I have to make the lesson entertaining in a way. I can't just go, you have to learn this. It's like, nah, I got to dress it up, make it interesting, relevant.
Well, it's true because her middle school French teacher is also an actress and she does shows around town.
Oh, that'll be fun.
She is a tad flamboyant. And so she does, I can imagine her in the classroom. I haven't seen her, but then I go in and I see Alexis teaching, and Alexis has this thing where she's using a lot of movement, a lot of song, and a lot of things that hit different parts of the neurons and the brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, we're not going to make you talk about brain work, Alexis. Even though I really wish we could. But in having that kind of a stimulation, it actually relaxes people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can let their guard down a little bit more and they can take a little bit of a risk. So what I'm thinking is, when people try to learn another language, they're terrified of looking a fool and making a mistake and saying possibly the wrong word. Well, I've spoken the wrong word many times, and people look at me and I just look at them and I'll say, what did I say?
Do they tell you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, like, for those of us that have learned language, we've done that so many times. And that's what I tell my students. I tell them all the dumb mistakes that I make all the time because it makes it so much more relatable. And to say, look, I survived and I learned from this and I'm never going to make that mistake again. And nothing bad happened.
Well, I want to add, too, that not only are you making mistakes, but you're making mistakes over and over again. So you have to be, like, very persistent with a new language.
Yes. We call those fossilized errors. There is a term for it.
Fossilized. Oh. I like it. Yeah, I try not to make the same errors twice, but.
But I have found that students, when I try to speak Spanish to them, they look at me and say, just speak English, because I don't know what you're saying, because they speak a different dialect of Spanish mm-hmm. than I do, because mm-hmm. theirs comes yeah. from Mexico and Central America. I'm used to Spanish. And yeah. I met a guy who was a translator. He moved here from Spain. His wife was from Puerto Rico. And he had a terrible time translating, because he said he had to learn almost like an entirely new language in order to do the translations in speaking and listening to people. Yeah. And yeah. so he was doing more translation for himself as well. How
interesting.
How do you develop fluency, though, and confidence?
Yeah. So one thing I really like to talk about to people outside of world language is the concept of fluency, because mm-hmm. I would argue that people who have learned second language later in their life, so meaning somebody who didn't grow up learning two languages, I started learning second language as an adolescent. Mm-hmm. So for those people who are lifelong language learners that started later, I feel like the word fluency doesn't really mean much anymore, because I've been speaking Spanish for almost 20 years and I still don't feel like I'm fluent. I've been studying French for over 20 years. I still don't feel like I'm fluent. So people who are lifelong learners will never feel like they've made it. You know what I mean? That being said, ACFL, who I referenced earlier, has that scale of proficiency. So it's an inverted pyramid, is what we call it, the inverted pyramid of proficiency. It starts with novice low and it goes all the way up to superior. The only people who are superior speakers are like diplomats and college professors in their native language. Like, most of us do not function at a superior level most of the time. Like in English, I function around an advanced to distinguished level most of the time, mostly advanced. So then the question is, where is the goal for our students in a language class? And what do we consider fluent? So if I'm functioning in my native language at an advanced level most of the time, is advanced considered fluent? I'm also an advanced speaker in Spanish, but I don't consider myself fluent. So the definition of fluent, and I tell my students this, and I like put the pyramid up on the wall and show them, because I want them to know that there's no, obviously there's goals for us in fluency in quotation mm-hmm. marks, mm-hmm. but you're never done learning, but I don't want that to be discouraging. I want that to be encouraging. So you're talking about making errors. Yeah. There are certain points in that proficiency spectrum where when you stop making a certain type of error, you can kind of advance to the next level. So it's really about goal setting with students. It's not saying, okay, my goal is for you to be fluent by this level by this time. It's, you started off the year at a novice low. How am I going to get you up to a novice mid? What does a novice mid look like? And so helping them build that self-reflection and building in that there will be errors that are expected. I think that we talk about growth mindset all the time, right? That's integral mm-hmm. to a growth mindset in learning languages. Mm-hmm. And helping them develop that, I think, is providing them, another term that gets thrown around a lot in world language, providing them a lot of comprehensible input. So I need to be giving them mm-hmm. constant input in the target language, whether it's me giving them input or them getting it from like a video, an article, something they're seeing, looking at, reading. They need to be getting that input constantly, but it needs to be at a level that's comprehensible for them. So if I walk into my Spanish one class and I turn on the TV to Univision and they're sitting there watching TV, it's not comprehensible for them, right? They are getting a lot of Spanish, but not taking it in. However, if I go in and I play a YouTube video that's made for maybe kindergarten, where they're showing lots of words on the screen, lots of images that support their understanding, they're going to get more of that. It's going to be much more comprehensible. And so that will help them build their capacity and build their vocabulary and their knowledge of structures much quicker with that constant input that's comprehensible.
But would a good analogy be English mastery, being a superior user of English, a superior speaker of English, would be kind of reserved for people like Doris Kearns Goodwin or Ernest Hemingway? People that had worked the craft of words and language to such an extent that they were superior masters of it?
Well, it's not even necessarily the vocabulary they're using, but it's what they're doing with the language. So can they
Right.
an opinion, support Yeah. it? Can they talk about hypothetical situations? It's Mm. it goes beyond just plugging in the right words in the right places, but what you're Oh, using yeah. to convey.
Well, I guess my,
it's
my
not
point
just
is
wordsmithing.
The nuance of the language is Yes. the way they Oh, absolutely. Refined it, developed it. I mean,
Yeah.
they didn't just speak it. They sort of defined it in many ways. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So that's a good one. For you folks at home, it's that's a good analogy, I guess, to latch on to.
So I'm wondering, is it good to like break things down into units? So let's say that when you're first starting to learn, okay, you're my teacher. And let's say that you break it down into units. So the first thing is going to be, we're going to talk about my home life. So we know that I have, let's say that there's mom, dad, brother, sister, dog, cat. We're not going to get into gerbil and rat and everything like that, unless we really need to, and that's more of a sideline. But then we learn all the parts of the house and the relationships and everything like that. And the second one is Felipe goes to school. And then he starts learning things about school and everything. And then afterwards, it's Felipe has a job. And then what does Felipe do at his job? And is that the best way to do it in a context?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we talk about learning language in context. And oftentimes, curriculum developers will break that up into themes, right? And the funny thing is, especially working in the textbook industry now, it seems like every level one textbook across the board has the same themes for their units. It's like, talk about yourself, describe yourself, likes, dislikes, then it goes into school, then it goes into family, then it goes into food, then it goes into what do you do around town. So we want to have that context. And novice speakers, so that's usually the first 2 to 3 years of learning a language, novice speakers are going to talk about themselves almost exclusively. Yes, we teach them how to talk about other people, but most of the time they're going to be talking about themselves. So what is in their immediate environment? And yes, we want to bring those cultural pieces in from other countries, make sure that we're teaching those in the target language as well. But you hit it right on, Tony, saying that we need to teach it in context to them. Like, yes, I can give them a vocabulary list with those words that you were saying, but that's not the best way for me to impart that vocabulary to them or to get them to acquire that vocabulary. I need to show them short sentences that are comprehensible using that vocabulary so they have a lot of models and examples, and then they can see how they can plug themselves into that sentence and start using it to talk about themselves in their own context.
Okay. And then how do you teach reading and writing in the new language? Do you wait until they understand and then they can phoneticize it, or how do you?
That is going to be teacher, very teacher to teacher. That's going to be that's personal preference. But the way that I used to teach, I used to start class with students standing and we do the first half speaking. So I was focused really on the interpersonal. Mm-hmm. And I would have the words on the board. I've had images with the words. So they're seeing that, they're getting the input. But I'm not asking them to write. I'm asking them to speak and get a lot of practice and feel comfortable with that structure or vocabulary speaking. Then we would sit down and write. Spanish is going to be much easier in that context than another language because Spanish, you're writing every letter, you're saying every letter. I have not taught French in a very, very long time. So for me, that would be a huge challenge. And I know that there's incredible French teachers out there that have great ways of teaching those things. I can't speak to them. But I think having the context of having the spoken is really important with the writing. I feel like you can't just ask kids to read and write without hearing the sounds and associating the sounds with what they're reading and writing.
It seems to me that that's the first entry into any language is just using it, seeing it, building a vocab. Writing is extremely difficult.
Well, and you also have to look at if you are only going to take a language class for 2 years, let's say you take Spanish for 2 years in high school, what is your end goal at the end of that 2 years? Are you going to be using written Spanish or are you going to be using spoken Spanish? Most likely you're going to value the speaking skill more so than the written skill, because you might be traveling or you might encounter somebody who only speaks Spanish in the United States and you need to communicate somehow. So for me as a learner, that's going to be more valuable than being able to write a paragraph describing myself. But if I am getting off the plane in Costa Rica and I need to fill out my custom form, that written Spanish is going to be really important for me in that context.
Mm-hmm. So how does language reflect the culture? Because I know that you're very much into absorbing culture. And if I'm correct in remembering, there's something about you absorbing as much culture in Mexico and in Costa Rica as you possibly could when you go down there, because you just love going down there. And that's one of the reasons, that's another part of you wanting to be a language teacher.
Culture is what gives us context for the language, I feel like, in a lot of ways. Because if I learn Spanish and I'm just always going to be in the United States talking about my own life, do I need Spanish for that? Not necessarily. I can do that in English because most of the people around me speak English and my context is English. But if I'm going somewhere else, especially if I'm going to live there for an extended period of time, like a study abroad or something like that, just having the words in Spanish for things that I would do here in the United States isn't going to help me, right? I need to know, like you were giving the example earlier, Tony, of like somebody who speaks Spanish from Spain isn't going to be a good translator in Latin America necessarily until they learn the subtleties of that culture. It's the same thing. If I go to Mexico, I need to know the vocabulary, the context for that country where I'm going to be if I really want to immerse myself in that, versus in Costa Rica, it's going to be slightly different. One example that I give to my student, like a very simple example, and it's called interculturality, to be able to use the target language correctly in the context of the culture. So I'm trying to build my intercultural capacity. And so one simple example I give is that a tomato. So we have the word tomate in Spanish, right? Mm-hmm. In Mexico, a tomate is a green tomato and a jitomate is a red tomato. So just even that one slight difference in Mexico, that doesn't mean that same thing in other countries. So if I go to Spain, for example, and I ask for a tomate, they're going to give me a red tomato. But in Mexico, they're not. So that's just an example of like, obviously, some things are going to be a much bigger deal than just asking for what color tomato you want.
Or even something that we associate with Mexico, the tortilla.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, I am in Ecuador, and every Sunday I would have my tortilla. But a tortilla is an omelet.
Yeah.
So, because they don't associate with Mexican foods. And so as there's different associations with food a lot.
Yeah. And that goes with a lot of language too, because there's so many words in Spanish that are regular everyday words in one country and then offensive swear words in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's a good time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
so when we talk about effective ways of learning a language, I think we can all determine that immersion might be the best way to go, use it, see it, be it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. But we're not going to have that. We're not going to be able to have that experience for all of our students, right? Like,
I know. Yeah.
Which I wish, wish that somehow, like, you know how middle schoolers go to outdoor school? I wish we could do that for languages too. I wish we had a way of saying, like, we're going to take you, even if it was a camp in the United States somewhere where they could only speak the target language for a little bit. That would just be so cool.
But and they have kind of culturally acclimatize it as best possible too. You know, make it as immersive as humanly possible. Yeah.
They do have language camps.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
But they're horrendously expensive and very exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the problems. I think that if you had made an immersion where you could take half a population of native speakers and half a population of Americanese and throw them in together and somehow or other mix them so that everything was in Spanish, because maybe we're trying to affect the literacy rate in Spanish for those students that go there. And also help the American students who go there who don't speak it. And so they're both gaining something. So there's something to be learned by for both parties for going. And one's not just doing the modeling, but they're also there to learn and to experience something. Mm-hmm. Is that?
I think it's a little complicated because by sending somebody who's already a native Spanish speaker to interact with people who are learners, there has to be a desire on the part of the native speaker to want to engage in that environment. Because a lot of times there's native speakers that are like, look, I speak Spanish, but that doesn't mean that I want to teach other people how to speak Spanish. And I respect that. Mm-hmm. I think that they have to know what they're doing. However, there are people that really do, you know, say, hey, you're interested in my first language. I would love to help you learn that first language because that's a big part of me and my culture. And yeah. It's also complicated because I had a lot of heritage language speakers. So I had a lot of heritage Spanish speakers in my Spanish class because they didn't necessarily have another place to go at the time. So you get somebody who's spoken Spanish since they were born, thrown into my Spanish 3 class, which isn't necessarily the appropriate place for them to go. And it's hard for me to serve that student well when I have 35 other students in my class that are trying to learn Spanish for the first time. But I think trying to make those students part of the conversation without making them stand there as the representative of their own culture, their own language, is an art form, to be honest. And I don't know if I ever
think that well. That's amazing. You're right. I didn't think of that. You're totally right.
But I think they're not going to go to camp unless they want to for some reason. Oh, maybe they want to learn translation. Mm. Maybe they want to learn how to interpret. Maybe they something like that. I mean, that would be great for those skills because those jobs are in high demand.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not easy to be a translator.
No, it's not.
No, you have to be a translator. Not only speak a different language and translate it, and you got to do the translating thing.
Well, you have to have a brain that can, brain that can listen and translate and do multiple things because not only are you intaking, you're fumbling around for the right words and you're speaking out the translated language at the same time that you're still continuing to listen.
I have to ask this of Alexis. So language, I noticed that the English language is catapulting offwards in different directions. A lot of the times, you know, we have slang, some of it sticks, some of it doesn't. There's different forms. Is that true of, say, Spanish or French? Do you know? And if absolutely. It is, how much of a challenge is that to keep up with if you're not immersed in speaking it all the time?
Yeah, language is constantly changing. And we know that, especially with technology. Like they take in other languages, they'll take English words for technology and then like add an ending to them. So it becomes a verb in that other language. It's just incredible. And trying to keep up, I think, is impossible. And I think that's where students are actually a resource because they're going to follow the TikToks. They're going to follow the videos. They're going to follow all these influencers who maybe only speak that target language or who speak both English and that target language. And they're going to be the ones that say, like, if I'm teaching and I say, oh, my textbook says that when you go to click on something, you say, hacer clic en blah, blah, blah. And then they'll say, no. Ms. Busher, actually, this girl that I follow on TikTok uses this to say click on something. Or I don't know. That might be a bad example because are teenagers even clicking on anything? Probably not, right? They're just like tapping buttons. Tapping. But that's an example of like, and another place where I think our heritage speakers can come in and say, no. That's not how we say this. Now we're saying this. And it's also really interesting where you get these huge international celebrities like Bad Bunny, for example. He's a singer who is a Spanish speaker and his music has blown up. So now people who don't even speak Spanish are obsessed with his music, right? So his music or words that he uses are going to start influencing the culture and the words that our younger students or younger speakers are going to start using on a regular basis. So language is constantly changing and it's really from the textbook industry. It's fascinating to me where, you know, you publish a textbook in 2020, and in the next couple of years, a lot of the vocab used to describe certain things isn't going to be used anymore.
Right. They're outdated.
Yeah. And Bad Bunny's teaching teaching Spanish to people.
Well, it's not just him. I mean, you've got Pitbull, you've got a whole bunch of them, and you have all the other rappers.
I mean, I remember words that I learned from songs, like all the way back from when I was in middle school. I remember those songs, and I like, for example, I just went to a Juanes concert last week, and I remember when I learned the song La Camisa Negra, I learned like three or four words in that song, and I can remember exactly when I learned them. So I think music is just so powerful in that way.
That's very true. It's proven.
Well, that also goes along with the context of culture in the language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So because it depends on whether or not you're a descriptivist or a prescriptivist when it comes to linguistics, depending on which language you're on. And so what you're doing is you're taking a descriptivist approach. And my understanding is that textbooks are already out of date by the time that they're published. And so if language is going that quickly, then does that mean that they are going to start having to make the textbooks digital so that they can update them and keep them going? Is it more profitable?
Here's
to chop it. Go ahead.
I love that question because it is so interesting to be in the position that I'm in right now, where I'm seeing it from the textbook side of things and also seeing it from the teacher perspective, because you want to create a digital product that can constantly be updated and changed so that it's relevant. However, I cannot tell you how many teachers and school districts I talk to all over the country that say, we have been on the computer too much. I need something printed. I need to print handouts so my students can physically write. They use Google Translate too much. And so I don't want them to be on the computer at all. So then how do you make a product like that where it's constantly updated, but it's also in a physical format for people? Like that's a tough ask.
Newsprint.
Do you send a binder and then you send updated binders like once a month?
Oh God, please don't do that. No, mailings? No.
But it's an interesting place we're in. I mean, I'm sure it's not just language. I'm sure it's every subject, right? Where you want to keep things updated, but then you don't want your kids on the computer all day. You want them to be talking to each other and having real conversations and actually listening and being immersed in whatever's happening in the moment.
And yes, the language is communication. Pushing online, so.
Language is a form of communication. If you watch the movie, it's called The Black Rose? No. The Black Robe. The Black Robe, where I can't remember if it's a missionary or who it is. He goes up to, maybe it's the Algonquins. I don't remember which tribe it is.
They introduce that. Yeah,
but they introduce writing to them and they show them. He says, tell me something. And then he writes it down. And then he shows it to somebody who was not part of the conversation and is far away. And he hands it to him. And the guy says, what the elder of the tribe said, and the elder is absolutely floored. He can't believe it. And so it's the impact of the language, and the language does describe what's going on, and that's why in our literature is like a microscope to the society for which it was written. And at the time that it was written in. So if we obliterate those texts, we've obliterated history and the way people think and the way people view the world, whether we agree with it or not. We still need to be able to understand that, and we do that best with the literature, depending on where we are. And so that's why I'm thinking, you know, being able to read something that's not translated, but for ourselves, and I know that this is a much later version of learning the language. I know that when I was at university, we had to start reading novels in, I think it was French 102.
Oh, that's early.
That is early. And
I think we did. We began by reading Le Silence de la Mer, and it was impactful. It was really, really difficult. But it was, I think that really helped a great deal. In fact, I kind of want to read it again. And then we also had to read Huis Clos, which is No Exit by Sartre, and 103.
Wow. Wow. So that is a demanding university program.
I was going to say, dang, dude. Well, you know, a good analogy would be in English, Huck Finn, you know, and the use of the N-bomb there to describe Jim, you know, yeah. because that was part of his integral character. And then when Huck considered Jim, like, no, he's not, you know, he's not a slave. He's my friend. That's an epiphany. That's a shift. And it's a huge one. Mm-hmm. And you can't really scour that novel out of some of those words, especially the N-bomb. It just has to be taken in context in that novel. And it's really important to understand what it would have been like for the two of them in that period of time. So that's a, you know, that's sort of the initial original translation of that novel to give.
Right. And it's the humanization of yeah. Jim, as yeah. opposed to being this thing that you can use that term with.
Yeah. Through the words that he used to refer to Jim is, you know, he's just, you know, he's my N-bomb slave. It's no big deal. And then later goes, no, he's my friend. I have to go back and help him. You know, it's like, yeah. wow, there's a big shift. And that was not lost on the audience at the time at all.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So getting back to this, Alexis, what are the biggest misconceptions about yeah. learning a second language?
I think, I don't think that students have misconceptions. I think parents do. When we talk about it in an educational context, especially mm-hmm. particularly public high school. Mm. And I think the misconception is that taking 2 years of a language in high school is enough and that you're going to be somewhat fluent after you take those 2 years. I think those are huge misconceptions. And actually preparing for this, I thought about what parents used to say to me in parent-teacher conferences. And I'd have parents say, oh, I took 4 years of high school Spanish and all I remember is, ¿dónde está el baño? I had another parent tell me one time, oh no, I made my student take Spanish 3 and 4 because when we go to Mexico on our vacations, they need to be ordering the beers for me. And to me, I'm like, all right, let's take the parents out of this for a minute and let's get down to the student level. Like, what are the yeah. students expecting out of this class? What do they want to do with the language? I think that's the biggest thing is to like bring it down to them, give them some realistic expectations and say, look, if you're only here for 2 years, that's fine. Here's what you can expect to learn. Here's what I'm going to help you do. And ask, I used to ask, what do you want to learn? And we'd like have a big chart on the wall and write it down the first couple weeks of school. What do you want to learn? But I think the other conversation is to say, look, if your expectation is that you really want to communicate with this language and you want to speak and you want to continue going on with it, maybe go past those 2 years and then plan to look at it in university, because you never know. You might end up feeling like this is an obligation and then fall in love with it and keep going forever. Mm-hmm. So from the student teacher perspective, I think those are the misconceptions. And I think those are some of the ways that we can address them.
Excellent. Wow, that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah.
So any last words of wisdom on anything we haven't covered that you really, really have stuck in your craw?
There's a constant shift in language education. And right now we're kind of at a crossroads, and maybe a few years ago, this crossroads came up. I started as a very, what I would call traditional teacher when I started teaching. So I would say, here's your vocab list, here's your grammar, we're gonna do grammar tables. And I spoke a lot of English in class. And then based on experiences that I had in workshops and professional development and everything over the years, and I will say specific to world language professional development, not just general professional development, I learned how important it was to be speaking in the target language almost all of the time, even in level one. How to create a very welcoming and safe environment where I'm doing that, and that my students are also feel welcome to do that, and to focus really more on what students are doing with the language and how to do it rather than the pieces of vocabulary and grammar. And so I think when we talk about those parents who took 4 years of high school Spanish and don't remember anything, were they just translating vocab and filling out grammar charts, or were they actually using sentences that they wanted to learn that they were going to use later on? One of the first things I teach my level one kids, after they're done having a conversation with somebody, they turn to each other and say, gracias que te vaya bien, which if you go anywhere in Latin America and you leave a place a lot of times you will hear que te vaya bien, which is like, have a nice day. And so I teach my kids that phrase so that they never forget it. So now when they leave my classroom, they say, que te vaya bien. Or when they're leaving a store, they can say that. So teaching those things that are going to stick with them beyond nice. Donde está el baño, because yes, donde está el baño is very important.
It can be.
But teaching them those things that are going to contribute to their intercultural experience if they ever travel, or even with people in the United States, and focusing on giving them that input that's attract, like they want to learn it, they're engaged in it, and it's understandable to them. I think that's the combination for effective language teaching today.
Wow. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, no, yeah. I've learned a lot, and you put a lot of things into perspective for me, and hopefully for our audience as well. So
yeah. I'd like to thank you personally for undoing some of my prejudices. It's one of my favorite things to do. And
oh, good.
When they get this, when they see the light of day, they start to shiver. I go, hey, I've been thinking about some things wrong. Thank you. I appreciate that.
One thing I'm going to throw in, when I started teaching Latin, my students were so much more stoked about learning Latin than they were about French or Spanish. And I couldn't figure it out. And this is when I was teaching felons who are in residence. And I didn't understand why they took it on so well until I got a call from the residence and they said, please stop teaching them Latin. And I said, why? And they said, because they're conversing in it and we don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
I thought that was the loveliest thing that they could have actually done. It was so perfect.
That's
and I said, amazing. Why would I want to stop them learning something? Why don't you learn the language?
There you go.
Perfect. And they said, not my job. Those were their words. So
it said nowhere in the job description, Latin
right.
speakers.
So anyway, Alexis, I'm going to put your contact information in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you. This has been exceptionally wonderful, eye-opening, inspirational, and confirming.
Well, thanks for having me.
And next week, we will be discussing peer pressure, how that affects students, teachers, and everybody else in the educational community. So, until then, be safe, be well, keep your feet on the ground as you reach for the stars. Bye-bye.